Made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about recent events in Libya. Over the past few months, the country has moved to improve its relations with the West. Last August, the government accepted responsibility for the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and agreed to pay compensation to the families of the victims. Then in December, Libya agreed to abandon its efforts to develop weapons of mass destruction and to allow inspections. We'll talk about what it is that has brought Libya to this point this morning in the first hour of the show, and we'll be talking with Dirk Vandewalle. He's associate professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College and has been following events in Libya for some time. He's the author of a couple of books on the subject, including Libya Since Independence, a book published by the Cornell University Press, and another which he edited titled Gaddafi's Libya 1969 to 1994, and St. Martin's Press is the publisher on that book. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be long distance for you, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We just ask callers to be brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call. Professor Vandewalle, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure, you're welcome.
I think it would be natural to assume, as the Bush administration has asserted, that the events here we've been talking about over the last few months, the moves of the government of Libya to improve its relations with the West, have to do with the Iraq War. And the administration has said, you see, this is an example of a success growing out of the Iraq War. And we could imagine that the man who has been running Libya now for some years, Colonel Gaddafi, seeing what happened to Saddam Hussein and deciding that he didn't want that to happen to him. However, if you look closely and read some of the reporting that's been done on this, you begin to realize that Libya has been inching in this direction slowly for years. While it may be that the Iraq War played some role in this, it's perhaps not directly attributable to the war. So having said all that, I guess the question is, what has motivated Libya and its leadership to try to improve relations with the West, to open up, to say we're going to abandon our efforts at building weapons of mass destruction, and you can even come in and look?
Well, the process, as you said, has a lot of times now been attributed to the war in Iraq. In effect, when you look very carefully, as you hinted in the second part of your introduction, the ongoing developments in Libya and the turn toward opening up Libya both politically and economically, in fact, have virtually nothing to do with the war in Iraq. The opening process that you described started in Libya in earnest about 2-3 years ago. And it was fueled by a number of events, both internal and external. Internal, first of all, the dire economic situation in which Libya found itself, and the fact that, to some extent, the sanctions, both by the UN and by the United States, had been successful, and had been successful particularly in the oil industry. Libya's oil industry is roughly 40, 45 years old, and it's coming really at the end of its useful life in terms of some of the infrastructure. So therefore, Libya really needs to revamp that industry, needs to get new pipe laid in the country, needs to do more exploring, needs to get more technology, new technology, both to update its refineries, but also to find offshore oil, for example. These were primarily the internal factors, and the one that is normally not mentioned in the media in the West is that over the last few years, we have seen emerge in Libya something that I think close observers of the country have pointed out, but has been lost in the general media cover of this, and that is that we've seen in Libya the emergence of a younger generation, a more technocratically oriented generation that has slowly but steadily started to infiltrate the political system. And perhaps the best example of one of these new people getting into the system has been the current Prime Minister Shukri Ghanem, who is a Western-trained economist with a PhD from the United States. And these young people have argued very steadily for opening up the country, for making decisions that are more based on technocratic rather than political criteria. And they have been relatively successful, although their ultimate success still remains to be debated. But nevertheless, they have, particularly when combined with the economic difficulties and the kind of isolation, political isolation that the government was under, to promote some kind of very slow change inside the country. So this was the internal part of the change. And as I said, this really goes back 2-3 years. On the other side, the international side, certainly the Lockerbie incident was one important threshold for the Gaddafi government to cross. And they did so in part, again, because of the international isolation and the sanctions and so on, but also because, again, there was inside the country a growing feeling that the kind of isolation and the kind of pressure that was being put on Libya really had to come to a halt, in a sense that they had really come at a crossroads, and they needed to either develop, they needed to open up the economy, they needed the international economy, they needed international advisors to come back in. And so the combination of both internal and international factors are really what prompted this recent development. And indeed, the recent developments that we've seen are really only the tip of the iceberg, in a sense. There was a lot of diplomatic back-channeling going on over the last 2-3 years, both by British and by American parties, and then a third party that also took part in this process. So again, it's a combination of internal and external factors that really precedes the Iraq war by at least a couple of years.
We have a caller, and we can get into some of these things in greater detail, but someone on a cell phone, so I don't want to make them wait. We will get to them right now on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to pose a question to you, and then I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Given that Libya was moving towards a, I don't know if it's a real connection with the Western world, what do you think of the possibility that the Bush administration might have said, you know, we know you're doing this, and it would really be helpful to us if you could do this at this particular time so that we could take credit for it in terms that you were doing it because of Iraq. In other words, the United States asked Libya to make their announcement at this particular time for their own political purposes, and that there might be something coming down the road to help Libya in exchange for the timing. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Is that question clear?
Sure. I mean, certainly that is one of the charges that has always been made, that in a sense there was a quid pro quo here between the Bush administration and the Libyans, particularly in light of the upcoming elections and so on. In a way, and certainly in a sense, Mr. Bush himself encouraged that scenario by, particularly in his State of the Union address, directly making that kind of link. Although, if you look very carefully to the language that he used in his State of the Union address, he did not really claim a direct link. He just said in general that the kind of pressure that was put on Iraq, you know, would move other countries like Libya towards opening up. In effect, he did not make a direct link. And he did not make a direct link in part because I think Mr. Bush was perfectly aware that the process with the American side had started much earlier on, had started with negotiations between Condoleezza Rice and some of her British counterparts at a meeting at Camp David where this had been approved. So it really predates. Frankly, I don't think that there is a direct link here. All the indications are that the Bush administration, following on the Clinton administration, very carefully investigated and through back channels was willing to see how far this could go way before the Iraq war actually started. So there is no direct link. Certainly the Bush administration would like to claim it as a victory, but in a way that is also very dangerous because if you do that directly, what in effect you are saying is that There is a link here between flexing your muscle and the political outcome in the case that we've seen here in Libya. In effect, that is dangerous because you make it appear as if strength by itself, the threat of power, using power, military power, that is, can translate into these kinds of victories. In effect, what we've seen in Libya is exactly the opposite. We've seen a long diplomatic process, both on and off the record, through numerous parties in numerous settings, and it was particularly a carrot-and-stick diplomacy by the Bush administration, by the Blair administration in Great Britain, that bit by bit pulled the Gaddafi government into the kind of concessions that it was willing to make. So I think the analogy that it was purely done for political purposes and that it was purely the result of our flexing our muscle in Iraq is simply the wrong analysis.
Other questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dirk Vandewalle. He's associate professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth and has written a couple of books on Libya and has been following events in Libya for some time. Questions, as I say, are welcome. You talked in the beginning about the fact that the economy of the country is in very bad shape, particularly its oil industry, as a result of sanctions that have been in effect for a number of years. The United States first imposed sanctions in 1986 in response to terrorist attacks in Rome and Vienna that the Libyans were implicated in. And then after Lockerbie, when it was established that Libya was involved, the United Nations imposed sanctions. That was in 1992. Now, those have been lifted after the Libyan government accepted responsibility for the bombing, but the U.S. sanctions remain in place. Can you talk a little bit about what exactly the nature of these sanctions are or were?
Sure. I mean, the U.N. sanctions were much more, were in a sense broader, and because they were broader, in a sense, were much less effective to some extent than the United States sanctions. The United States sanctions were primarily meant to prevent any kind of export toward Libya of any type of material that could be used in the Libyan economy. And so it covered, for example, oil supplies, oil technology, and so on. So that was particularly the sector that Libya was really interested in. Libya still had trade with Europe, and indeed the Italians continued to do trade with Libya uninterrupted, as most of the European countries did, although with a bit of skepticism. The United Nations sanctions were primarily, from the Libyan point of view, a bother because of travel restrictions. You could not get in and out of Tripoli or Benghazi by air, so you had to either come in through Malta or Tunisia or one of the other neighboring countries. So those were in hand, but it was particularly the American sanctions that were biting and to some extent continued to bite. And, of course, the big question is now how soon those sanctions will be lifted.
We have a caller here to go to on line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask about sort of the background of, since you've written a historical work on Libya, the role it played in breaking the consensus of the oil arrangement when an Occidental opened up a different arrangement with the Libyans for oil that sort of had to be followed, and just the way the oil companies are so prominent in this arrangement. But then I think you're Dutch, and I don't have it at hand, but I rather read a rather scathing, I'm presuming that you were.
I'm Flemish, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. But anyway, there was a prominent Dutch jurist who watched the Lockerbie trial, and he wrote a rather scathing review of it, it seems to me. And I just, I don't know what to make of it. He calls into question the trial, and basically it may be a case where it was choreographed to produce the results, which may have been valid in any case, but he just, it's not widely commented on here. Maybe it is more in Europe, but I don't know if you know anything about that, but also the first question I'll have to
run.
Thank you.
Let me answer the first question first, particularly since you referred to Occidental Occidental, which was a rather small independent oil company operating in Libya. The Gaddafi government, as you may know, had been instrumental in the early 1970s in pushing through at a number of conferences the kind of changes that led to the quadrupling of oil prices in 1973, and indeed a lot of analysts have really traced the beginning of the antagonism between the United States and Libya to those early events and to the stand that Colonel Gaddafi took at those negotiations. Remember that Libya, under the monarchy in 1967, had already stopped in 1967 after the Six-Day War, had already stopped oil deliveries to the West, in part because of the nationalist wave that was then wafting over the area, including Libya. But the actions of the Gaddafi government were seen as much more hostile, in a sense. Now, in Libya, the oil industry, in a sense, was rather unique. And it was rather unique because, in addition to representatives from what were called the seven big sisters at the time, or the seven sisters, the major multinationals that we tend to think of when we talk about the oil industry in the 1970s, 80s, and early 1990s, in Libya, there were as well a number of small independent companies, including Occidental and roughly about half a dozen others. And Libya had deliberately structured its concessions so that, in a sense, it would have a broader participation and would not be dependent so much on these major multinational corporations. The result of that was that whereas the big multinationals always could shift production in case of a boycott, for example, in Libya, these smaller producers like Occidental and so on could not. And it is exactly what the Libyan government then started to do after 1973. It started putting pressure on these independent companies to fall in line with the price hikes and with the general policies of then emerging, or I should say, evolving OPEC regulations. At that point, the independent companies, who were much weaker and incidentally could not get support from the big multinationals if they tried to do so in terms of deliveries of oil and so on, these smaller companies had no choice but to give in to what the Gaddafi government wanted. And in a sense, it led to the unraveling of the oil industry and the concessions in Libya, but then, of course, had ripple effects throughout the region. What it meant, in effect, was that the Gaddafi government almost by default took over a number of these participations, but did so in a very interesting way. For example, in 1986, after the U.S. imposed its embargo, the Libyan government never completely nationalized the holdings of the Oasis Group, as it was called, of which Occidental was part. Indeed, the concessions that these companies have in Libya are still on the books. And as a matter of fact, the Gaddafi government has made it very clear that these companies are welcome to go back and will have original title to their claims as they did when they left in 1986. So the Libyan oil industry is quite different, or used to be quite different, until the takeover of by the National Oil Company than a lot of other countries in the region. And hence, the kind of outcomes that we've seen and the role that the Gaddafi government could play in a sense playing off small companies versus big companies versus the U.S. government and so on was rather unique. It introduced a kind of vulnerability in the oil industry in Libya that we didn't see so much in other countries. Now, to turn toward your second question, the question on the trial in The Hague in Holland, there has been, and I think you're absolutely right, this has not been covered very well in the United States. It has been covered to a much larger extent in Europe. There has been a certain unease among some of the people who follow this very closely, and I was at a couple of conferences in which at least two of these jurists were, and they both, in a sense, reiterated what you have just said, that there was an enormous amount of pressure put on the court to behave in a certain way. I'm not sure how much to believe of this, although one of the jurors, whom I really respect, made a very forceful argument. This was before the appeal of the sentence, in which he very accurately predicted what would happen at that second trial. And so I think there is probably some credibility that there was some pressure put on the court to produce a certain outcome. Although, again, it is very difficult to say what is direct pressure, what is indirect pressure, what was contributed within the kind of environment in which that trial took place. Let me maybe leave it there. I'm not sure I have much more to say about it at this point.
Well, just the Libyan government has formally accepted responsibility for the bombing, handed the two men over to trial, and as you say, at least initially in the first trial, one man was found guilty and one not. Mm-hmm. Does anyone question whether in fact Libya was involved and exactly, because apparently the government has not been forthcoming with a great deal of detail. Essentially, it has just said, yes, we, the government of Libya, accept responsibility. They haven't really said, I think, very much else.
Right. The Libyan government has really been quite circumspect, in part, of course, for a number of legal implications down the road. They've accepted responsibility, but again, in a sense, not really direct responsibility. And so there are a number of issues remaining. Indeed, the big issue focuses really on the American sanctions, which the administration has said will not be lifted until an apology is issued by Libya. And an apology, in a sense, really would then come much, much closer to saying that the Libyan government, or at least the Libyan government, by apologizing, would agree much more explicitly that it was really directly involved in the Lockerbie incident. So that still needs to be resolved, and indeed that is what is holding up to some extent the lifting of the American sanctions and the fact that the ILSA rule, the Iran and Libyan Sanctions Act, remains in place until today. There are some other issues as well, but certainly the Lockerbie issue and the apology over the Lockerbie issue remains the big issue on the books as we speak.
We have someone else to talk with in Chicago. This is line number 4. We'll go there next.
Hello. Hi.
Yes.
Occidental Petroleum 30 years ago or so claimed to have discovered a huge aquifer under Libya. How much? And they claim that this would be sufficient to turn the desert to practically a Garden of Eden. How much truth was there to that, and what has developed from it?
Well, the discovery of aquifers in Libya actually has a very, very interesting historical history to it, and that is the discovery of water in southern Libya, particularly around an area called Kufra, was made actually by the Italians in the early 1930s. And the Italians at the time, or I should say actually later on during the monarchy, from 1951 to 1969, made an agreement with the then-current king, King Idris al-Zanusi, to explore the water resources and to bring water to the surface in great quantities. In return, and this is the kind of fascinating aspect, in return for the right to drill for oil in that particular part of the country. Now, you may ask yourself, why would the Libyans and the king be interested in that particular area? Well, it was in part because the Zanussis and the tribal affiliations, the tribals affiliated with the Zanussis, were concentrated in that particular part of Libya. So the knowledge that the water was there long before Occidental came into the picture. Occidental then and the Oasis Group got a big concession in what is called the Sarir platform, which is inland from Libya and is indeed the most productive area in Libya, or at least was in terms of production. As far as I know, Armin Hammer raised the issue of water again, and indeed there were some implicit promises made, from what I understand, that the American company would do essentially what the Italians couldn't do because of World War II, and that is get involved in the aquifer exploitation around Kufra and the surrounding area. In a sense, they were preempted because when the Gaddafi government came into power in 1969, and they saw as one of their priorities to exploit these aquifers in southern Libya. And they could do so relatively easy because if you think going in from the Libyan coast, you're actually going all the way very, very slightly uphill toward Kufra. And so it was a relatively, from an engineering point of view, from what I understand, a relatively easy thing to bring that water to the coast. And indeed they have done so. What is now called the Great Man-Made River Project is a roughly $28 to $29 billion scheme to bring water from that aquifer in two or three different stages, first to the coast directly down from Kufra to Ajdabiya, but then also to Tripoli, Benghazi, and so on. Most of this is now online. The water is coming into Tripoli, and it was originally predicted that there would be enough water there for roughly 50 years at a minimum. There is some skepticism among engineers that indeed there is that much water, or that indeed they can keep pumping water for that long before they have some breakage and leakage and so on in the pipe. So it's a little disputed, but nevertheless, it certainly is a project that is online. At one point, the Gaddafi government also used it to, and the kingdom, I should say, before the Gaddafi government, used it to grow wheat around the Kufra area, but the price of the wheat itself, just the transport cost of the wheat to the coast, was roughly about 10 times as much as the world price of wheat at the time. So they abandoned that scheme, and also to raise cattle in the area, for now bringing the water to the people, so to speak, rather than bring people to the water in the southern part of the country.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana where we are. We do also have that toll-free line. If you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. It's 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dirk Vandewalle. He's associate professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth and has been following politics in Libya for some time. He's the author of the book Libya Since Independence. That's published by the Cornell University Press. You talked a little bit earlier about some of the reasons that have brought Libya to this point, this place where it's trying to improve its relations with the West. Partly it's the pinching of the sanctions imposed by the UN and the U.S. Partly you said that it is as the result of an emergence of a younger generation of leadership. People like the current prime minister, Ms. Ghanem, that you mentioned. Someone else that I've also seen mentioned in an awful lot of stories that I've been reading over the last couple of months here about Libya is one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons, Saif, I think is his name. Is he someone who is a significant player in politics now in Libya?
Yes. Well, Saif al-Islam, or Saif for short, as he is known, is a very interesting person within Libya right now. He is, on the one hand, certainly one of these younger people who are thinking of reform in Libya. Indeed, he is getting his PhD at the London School of Economics, where I met him a while back and had a chance to ask him a number of questions. And certainly, so on the one hand, he is that kind of, you know, what we would call a kind of a modernizing people within, you know, what used to be essentially a tribal system. But on the other hand, he is also obviously the son of Muammar Gaddafi. And so he's not really at liberty to perhaps act upon what he would like to do. So he's a very interesting person because he's caught between the two. Now, the big question here in terms of Libyan politics is what role Saif al-Islam will play in the future. Right now, he is certainly a privileged partner in Libyan politics. He sets up a lot of the negotiations with the British on a number of issues, including some of the oil business and so on. He is present at major international conferences. And so he certainly has been, in many ways, the spokesman for the regime until now. The big question, of course, is whether or not that is really symptomatic of future direction of Libyan politics. That is, are we seeing here a kind of a repeat of what we've seen in a number of Arab countries, that the father more or less anoints the son, who then becomes the power broker inside the country. And indeed, the Libyan opposition, particularly in the United States, has often argued that that is the case, and that Saif is being set up to become the number one in the country. I am not so sure, and I'm not so sure because I think Libyan politics has changed quite substantially since 1969. I am not sure that Saif al-Islam has enough political backing at this point, in case his father would die or disappear from the political scene, to really take over. What is one of the dominating feature of Libyan politics is, in a sense, that it remains in a rather fluid appearance at this particular point in time, in that there is really no settled political system. And the popular committee and popular Congress system that Colonel Gaddafi has put into place seems to me, at least, unlikely to survive once he disappears from the scene. And then the big question becomes, what happens to people like Saif al-Islam? Does the military step in? Does the military side with Saif al-Islam? What happens to some of the important tribal elite people within Libya? Do they side with Saif al-Islam? All of that, to me, does not seem clear at all. And so my hunch is that perhaps if Gaddafi, and the big issue here is how fast Gaddafi goes. If indeed what I've been portraying to you is accurate, that we're seeing a more technocratic generation coming online, so to speak, that the system is bureaucratizing itself, then the longer Gaddafi stays in place, the better, in a sense, because it means that the move toward a more bureaucratized, a more regularized political system is in the works, and so therefore the longer he stays in place, the better. If it comes very quickly, then I think, in a sense, all bets are off, and then which way Saif al-Islam goes, who sides with him, or whether or not he gets ranged out of the political system, to me, at this particular point in time, really still remains unclear. The only thing that remains clear is that the military, as an organized body, is probably the only organized polity, so to speak, in Libya at this particular point in time. So no matter what, I think the military in Libya in any succession scheme will likely continue to play a role.
What, to the extent that we know about public opinion in Libya, what can one say about how your average person feels about the way things are in Libya today and this possibility that there could be this opening to the West and this improving relations with the outside world?
There is actually a very good study that has been published by a Libyan sociologist / political scientist in Libya on this particular subject, quite contrary to what we may expect in the West. And in general, although certainly not unanimously, particularly the younger people and certainly a lot of the older people seem positively inclined toward Gaddafi. They have some skepticism about the workings of this popular committee and Congress system, but in general, there does not seem to be massive disenchantment with the political regime as it exists right now. I think in part that is because the Gaddafi government has been quite good at distributing a lot of the money that it gained. Certainly Libyans are not rich by any stretch of the imagination, but at least within the kind of ethos that a lot of Libyans, the kind of tribal Islamic ethos that they live in, the kind of things that Gaddafi has done certainly resonate, and I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind. So although there is disaffection, there is isolated opposition and so on, in general I think this is a political system that is reasonably well, either reasonably well supported among its population, or the alternative to that is that there is also a certain amount of apathy of Libyans who simply don't want to get involved in the political system at all.
As part of this opening up that we've talked about, Libya has agreed, the government of Libya has agreed to abandon its efforts to develop weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, nuclear. And apparently the outside, the West, had a fair idea of what sort of efforts there were in the direction of chemical weapons, biological weapons, but that there apparently was some surprise at the extent to which the country had tried to move towards producing materials to make a bomb and then get on to doing that, that that there was a period earlier, perhaps in the 70s and the 80s, where there was work in that direction, then it seemed to have fallen off. Then it seemed to have gained some momentum again in the 90s. Now, as I read, it's not a highly developed program, but was there some surprise that it was as developed as it was?
Well, I was at a conference about a week before the announcement came, and I had been involved in some off-the-record conferences on the side where some of this was discussed. At the public conference, which was in Washington, and they had a panel of experts on Libya, on WMD, et cetera. The analysis that was made at the conference, and as I said, a week before the actual announcements, was uniformly completely wrong. Most of the experts had absolutely, even on chemical weapons and so on, although they were more accurate, were certainly still far off. We, the United States administration and Americans in general, I think were quite surprised with the way particularly the nuclear aspect had been developed in Libya. We all knew to some extent about the chemical weapons and so on, but the traditional analysis had been that Libya, first of all, did not have the capability of producing or the technology or the knowledge to move toward a nuclear weapon, and I think in general that has been borne out. What I think we had forgotten was that a lot of this, and much, much easier than we had anticipated, and indeed that, of course, is now what is being debated so hotly, that the ability to buy this from a third party on the international market was so easy. And so when the British and American teams went in, particularly looking for the nuclear material, they were really astounded at the level of sophistication that the Libyans had been able to gain by simply buying on the international market, and by buying not only the brain power, so to speak, but also to get, for example, centrifuges and so on that they thought at that particular point in time we didn't have. So I think we were off substantially on all levels, including chemical weapons, but particularly in the nuclear arena. So that will be one of the points that I'm sure the administration will want to watch very closely for what it tells us, not simply about Libya, but also about this proliferation of access to knowledge and physical hardware related to nuclear production.
Mm. Well, obviously the lesson is there. It is perhaps even more difficult than we thought, than we knew, to try to stop the spread of hardware and knowledge. Indeed it's a very, very large and very complicated problem.
Absolutely, but I think it also underscores the point that I made initially, and that is that to some extent it is in the interest of the United States for the administration to make sure that they can portray this simply or not simply as a matter of power, of flexing your muscle, but also that really what led to the disclosures in Libya was really an involved and very fruitful diplomatic process using a lot of back channels, but nevertheless a very successful diplomatic process that conveyed to the Gaddafi government what was possible in terms of reestablishing relationships, and then in turn prompted the government to come across the threshold, so to speak. It's only if we can make that clear, these kinds of both carrots and sticks tactics that are being used to other countries, that we will have similar results in other countries and in other parts of the world.
What were the circumstances of Muammar Gaddafi's coming to power in 1969?
Well, the Gaddafi government really came to power after Libya. Let me back up a little bit. Libya had been established really as what I would call an accidental country almost in 1951. That is, it had been created primarily for strategic reasons by the United States and Great Britain. At that point, we needed a strategic base in the Middle East because it was still the only place at that point with the technology available that we could deliver a nuclear weapon into Russia at the time, together with Turkey later on. For 18 years, there was a monarchy under the man I have mentioned, King al-Zanusi, but by 1969, it was quite clear, I think, to most outsiders, indeed even to people working within the American embassy at the time who were reporting back on this, that the Zanusi government in many ways was out of tune. It was out of tune ideologically with the kind of nationalism and that was wafting across the area at the time. It was a political system that had been marked by lots and lots of corruption involving family members and close associates of the king. And so it was quite clear when Gaddafi came to power in 1969 that in many ways there was no more room for the monarchy. What was interesting was that the Gaddafi government, in a sense, represented, not so surprisingly, an almost a counterfoil to what the monarchy had been, and that is a lot of the people that the Gaddafi government attracted were people from the hinterland, away from the cities, away from the kind of elite families and so on that had supported the monarchy. So what you had, in a sense, was, although, you know, the colonel called it the Libyan Revolution, it never really was a true revolution, except perhaps in a sense that from a social point of view, it brought a lot of the young officers from poorer backgrounds into the political system, if you want to call it that, into Libya. And to a large extent, that has remained the base of support, along with these military men within the country, that has remained the base of support for the government and very much until today.
We have about 12 or 13 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Questions are certainly welcome. We're talking about Libya, and our guest for the program is Dirk Vandewalle. He teaches at Dartmouth and has been following politics in Libya for a long time. He's the author of the book Libya Since Independence, published by the Cornell University Press. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As we touched on the fact that the kind of negotiations, the conversation about Libya coming out, as it were, had been going on for a number of years, and that Britain was very important in this. Is there a particularly special relationship between the British and the Libyans?
Well, it's not been a special relationship, but the British, particularly because of their oil interests and general commercial interests, have kept a much closer hand in Libya than the United States has, and has not been willing to really do the kind of sanction work that the United States would have wanted. And Britain remains very involved. The major British oil companies are in Libya, so there is an interest there. But that interest, in a sense, I think goes beyond purely economic interest. The Blair government, in particular, really saw it in its interest, and I think in order to create some, not really publicity, but credit for itself, to really want to bring Gaddafi in. And they were worried about a number of things, among them, for example, the support that the Gaddafi government was extending to the regime in Zimbabwe, which of course impinged on some of the relations that the British had with the Zimbabwean government and Mugabe himself. So there are a number of reasons, and in a sense, of course, the British were part of the occupying forces after World War II, the British military administration in Libya and so on. So there is a historical link. There's also an educational link. Quite a few of the early Libyan people after independence were educated in Great Britain. And so there are all kinds of intellectual, commercial, and political links between the countries that have never really completely disappeared. And it was to revive those in part that the Blair government really took the kind of initiative to start on the road toward what eventually became disagreement on the weapons of mass destruction.
And so is it true that now a meeting has been scheduled? That is, Mr. Blair and Mr. Gaddafi are going to meet?
The British Foreign Minister has said that a meeting will be scheduled. I don't think it has been announced yet, but the Libyan Foreign Minister at this point has already met with his counterpart in Great Britain. And so it's generally expected that the meeting will take place. It's not been specified whether it will be in Great Britain or in Libya at this particular point in time. But certainly, in kind of light of where these negotiations are going, I would not be surprised at some point to indeed see that meeting taking place.
Mr. Gaddafi clearly at one point had ambitions to be a player on the world stage saw himself, at least some potential, as being a leader in the Arab world. And when that really didn't happen, was interested in perhaps becoming involved, more involved in African politics. Is he now, do you think, at a point in his life and his career where he realizes that some of his earlier ambitions simply aren't going to be fulfilled?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think Colonel Gaddafi always saw himself as the heir to Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian president, who died in 1970, just, you know, as Gaddafi was coming to power, so to speak. And indeed, in Libya, one of the most prevailing pictures you still see is a picture of a very young Gaddafi hand-in-hand with Gamal Abdel Nasser walking when Nasser visited Libya. That vision and the ability and the willingness to put money for pursuing that vision of Arab unity was, of course, something that Gaddafi always espoused in his early days and indeed pursued very vigorously throughout the 1970s and early 1980s. I think it was clear by the mid-1980s to most people in Libya, and certainly to Gaddafi himself, that that dream really had come to an end. That in a sense, as Gaddafi himself said on numbers of occasions, the kind of vision of Arab nationalism that he had was no longer alive in the Arab world. Indeed, he went much further. He castigated the Arabs for really not having a vision at all of unity anymore. And it was at that particular point in time that Gaddafi, I think willy-nilly, and for lack of an alternative, started turning towards sub-Saharan Africa, an area, by the way, that he himself had been very skeptical of and spoke scathingly of on a number of occasions prior to his turning towards sub-Saharan Africa. I think the turn towards sub-Saharan Africa is indeed an indication of the failure of his policy of trying to unite the Arabs, of Arab nationalism in general. And I should say there is very little love lost, particularly within Libya, among, I think, in general, the population, for a pro-sub-Saharan Africa policy in Libya. It has been criticized repeatedly, and even though Gaddafi pursues it, he certainly does not pursue it with the kind of ardor that he pursued his Arab nationalism, which, of course, all Libyans could share in. There are some traditional links between southern Libya and Chad and sub-Saharan Africa, but those links are rather tenuous, and at this particular point in time, 30, 40 years after the revolution, 35 years after the revolution, those links have really disappeared, I would think. So that turn toward sub-Saharan Africa is not popular in Libya, and my hunch is that sooner or later, and particularly if Gaddafi were to leave the scene, those kinds of initiatives will probably disappear.
We take another caller here from Chicago, line number four.
Yeah, hi.
Yes.
I've got another question for you.
Sure.
And you pretty much undercut me with your last sentences, and that my question is, what of Libya's relations with Chad, and what effect do the French have there? Also, what effect has the discovery of oil in Chad had? And one more thing, what part does Italy play in Libya now?
Mm-hmm. To answer your first question, your last question first, Libya is still very important in the Libyan oil industry. Most of the Italian multinational oil corporations are in Libya. Italy accounts for roughly 35% of Libyan oil that leaves the country, and Italy is also seen as, in a sense, the gateway, the connection between Libya and Europe in terms of downstream investment for the Libyans on the European continent. Chad is a very interesting puzzle. After the defeat by the Chadians in their war that lasted roughly on and off for about a decade, the Gaddafi government withdrew from Chad and ostensibly no longer showed an interest in it, in part, I think, fueled by the realization that there was very little they could do. And they could do very little in part because the French had made it very clear, and indeed the French had been instrumental in helping to engineer the defeat of the Libyan forces at a southern Libyan base close to Chad, Matanzasara. And so the French had made it very clear, in a sense, to the Libyans that they couldn't really cross that threshold, so to speak, into Chad. And because of all the other difficulties that the regime faced at the time, and then later on the destruction of the UTA jetliner, which needed negotiations between France and the Libyans, for all of those reasons, the colonel has really stayed out of Chad, at least overtly, as far as we know. The finding the oil in Chad has been interesting, and there were a number of references in the early period in the Libyan press about possible links and about bringing oil out through Libya and so on, which is physically almost impossible. And as you may know, the pipelines have now been constructed toward the west coast of Africa, no longer go into North Africa. And so I think for all practical purposes, Chad is lost, so to speak, to Libya, and will probably no longer feature prominently in Libyan politics, in part because the war in Chad was very unpopular in Libya.
I think that we're at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I want to thank you, Professor van de Walle. Thank you very much for giving some of your time today.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. Our guest, Derek van de Walle, is a professor at Dartmouth College. And if you're interested in reading some of his writing on the subject of Libya, you can look for his book. It's titled Libya Since Independence, and it's published by the Cornell University Press. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, you will hear a program from the Afternoon Magazine archives. Celeste Quinn is the host of the show, obviously getting underway at noon. She will be repeating an interview from about a year ago, talking with a man named Chandler Burr, who wrote a book titled The Emperor of Scent. It is all about a man named Luca Turin. He began collecting perfume when he was a boy in France. France, he told Burr, is a country of smells. That's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn. It gets underway at noon here on AM 580, with the usual mix of news and weather, sports, and so forth. That's the show that follows this one. Coming up in the next part of this show, Focus 580, we are going to be talking with another candidate for Senate here from the state of Illinois. And March 16th, there'll be a primary, and there's a very crowded field of both Republicans and Democrats who would like to represent their party in the race for the U.S. Senate. We'll be talking in the next hour of the show with one of the Democrats. Her name is Joyce Washington. So we hope that you can stay tuned for that.
Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nickel, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at thriftynickelads.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net.
At 1 minute past the hour, we'll have news from National Public Radio. First, though, we have an update on the commodity markets.